Good afternoon, everyone. Today is Wednesday, February 9th, 2022. Welcome to the Committee on Health and Human Services. And first up, we got other things coming through, but first up, we are going to hear from the Department of Health about the COVID waivers. And joining us for that today is Assistant Commissioner Diane Reidrich. So I think we saw her on screen here. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record, and you can continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for having us here today. And I'll just say I'm impressed you can already pronounce my last name correctly, because most people can't, even with a lot of practice. It's the all the whys throw people off, it seems. So again, thank you for having us here today to speak to the COVID waiver bill, which is an important initiative that we want to move forward in order to really have some kind of tailored support to hospitals and to nursing homes. Even as we're starting to see case numbers come down and hospitalizations come down, we know that there's still risk of further waves and further surges, and we just want to make sure that we've got the right kind of flexibilities in place going forward. So this bill, and I apologize, I forgot to introduce myself. For the record, my name is Diane Reidrich, and I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner of the Health Systems Bureau here at the Department of Health. So this bill would give time-limited authority to MDH to waive limits on the addition of hospital and nursing home beds in response to temporary surges in demand, and also make some modifications to storage provisions for the funeral industry. Again, this is a part of a broader suite of initiatives that we and others have put in place to provide support to hospitals and long-term care over the course of the pandemic to ensure that we're able to rapidly respond as demands change and needs change over time. This is a much narrower approach to waivers than what was in place during the emergency. So under the previous executive orders, our ability at the health department to waive certain requirements covered essentially any requirements that were included in a relatively broad range of statutes, not just related to hospitals and nursing homes, but to other provider types. Activities that the department, particularly when it comes to healthcare capacity, when a facility needs to make a change.
You know what?
Our statute.
We lost you there for just a little bit. So, for about 20 seconds, if you could just kind of bring us up to what you were saying, because we just had a bad connection.
Okay, I apologize, Mr. Chair. I just saw a notice saying I have an unstable connection. So hopefully. I'll try and go quickly before unstable turns to no connection. So again, this is a much narrower approach than what was in place during the emergency. Under the executive orders, we had authority to waive a wide range of statutes when needed. This is a much more tailored and time-limited approach based on what we've learned since that time about where the continuing challenges are for the providers that we regulate. And it's really about making sure that there's clarity on how to seek a waiver when there is a short-term surge in demand, so that we don't have to go through the same process of legal analysis and assessing the waiver and really communicating in kind of tailored ways to facilities at that time. And we've got that clarity for us and for them. Any waivers that are granted under this authority would expire by June 30th, 2022. So again, time limited. In terms of beds, this would provide support to hospitals and nursing homes who have physical space that would allow them to expand and that have staff to staff those beds, but they can't currently flex their capacity upwards due to moratorium language that we have in law. So just really want to say again, these are for temporary surges in demand. These are not about long-term changes to bed capacity, and it is not about new hospital construction. And there is language in the bill that clarifies that new construction is not the intent. This is not about building a new wing or building. This is about using the space you have in a different way. I know that you have a narrative that walks through the waivers, but I will just walk through them very quickly. So for hospitals, this language would allow for temporary modification of licensed bed capacity. Currently, Minnesota has a hospital construction moratorium, and it restricts any increase in the number of statewide hospital beds that we have. For a hospital to increase its bed capacity beyond what they are licensed for, they have to go through a public interest review, and they have to be added via an amendment to statutes 144A.50 to 591. So there is an explicit process that hospitals have to go through when they want to expand their capacity beyond what's under their license. Under this bill, a hospital could temporarily increase their number of beds above their license capacity without going through a public interest review. So that's important, because if they need to add beds to decrease ED wait times, we want them to be able to do that more quickly without having to go through that review and legislative process. For nursing homes, the proposal would allow those who have licensed beds in layaway, which is kind of like cold storage for beds. You have the beds, you're just not using them right now, so you set them aside, you put them in layaway. This proposal would allow nursing homes to move beds out of layaway and return them to active status without having to wait for the currently required 60-day notice requirement to play out. It would also temporarily lift the moratorium for nursing facilities to increase their bed capacity to meet demands. So that's adding non-layaway beds to their capacity. On the nursing home side, finally, it temporarily waives resident notification timelines for transfer and discharge of nursing home residents. Those are timelines that are in the Healthcare Bill of Rights, and the waiver would allow nursing homes to make moves of patients if they want to cohort them, or residents if they want to cohort them as a specialized COVID-19 site, or if they need to move residents because of staffing issues that are related to COVID. Finally, the bill would temporarily modify requirements for how long funeral homes, crematories, and alkaline hydrolysis facilities may hold a decedent pending final disposition. Current law says that the maximum number of days that one of these facilities can hold a decedent before final disposition is 6 days. And prior to COVID, that has been long enough to permit arrangements to be made and for a funeral or a memorial service to happen. But what we saw during COVID, in particular when families were delaying funerals or memorial services because of challenges related to travel or restrictions on gatherings, there were times when this posed challenges for the industry. And someone is knocking on my door, and my dog is barking, so I'm going to pause there and see if there are questions, and mute myself while I do.
Okay, thank you. Members, any questions for Ms. Redrick concerning what we've just heard, and looking at the A2 amendment? Is the amendment that follows the information that she just went over. We will talk about that now, but we will take and bring the amendment back up once we get to Senator Lang's bill here in a little bit. But for right now, any questions, concerns? Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, can you tell me whether there's any data collection done on, you know, on those, you know, like nursing homes and hospitals, I guess specifically, about when they do make changes like this? Is there data collected by MDH when these things happen, or are the homes and hospitals required to capture any information about it? If you could tell us a little bit more about that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Ms. Redrick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Wicklund, yes, we do have information on that. When hospitals or nursing homes have applied for a waiver to date, they submit an application or fill out a form to us that lets us know specifically what they are asking for. So if they're adding beds, how many beds they're adding, particularly on the hospital side, where in the hospital are they? And then we review that information, and our engineering team takes a look at it to see if there are any concerns around, you know, life safety code, fire standards, things like that, to make sure that it's physically a safe space for them. And we keep track of all of those applications that come in. We do have information about how many hospitals and nursing homes have applied for additional beds during the course of the pandemic, and we'd be happy to share that with you afterwards if you'd like.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wicklund, any follow-up?
No, that answers my question. And yeah, that, if I could find out a little bit more about, you know, what you're seeing and what you've seen over time, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? If not, it looks like we're good there. And we will take, and like I said, we've got the amendment, but we will have a little discussion on that when we get to, or after we hear about Senator Lang's bill. So if there's nothing else there, thank you, Ms. Reidrich, for your testimony today. I think we are good. Are you staying with us for the rest of the hearing? Okay, good. All righty. Senator Lang. Senator Lang brings us Senate File 2853 today.
Mr. Chair. I'll move the
Senator
bill.
Abler.
I'll move the bill if you like.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Abler moves Senate File 2853 to be before us.
Well, good morning, or excuse me, good afternoon,
and
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Lang, before, now that you've got everybody at the table with you, I see that you do have a delete all amendment. Would you like to offer that, or should we offer that right now? You're ready for it, and then get the correct language before us? Is that the intention?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you wanted to move that, we could do that.
Senator Dreheim, would you move the, we have the A1 delete all?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I would like to offer the A1 amendment to Senate File 2853. It is a delete all.
Thank you. Members, everybody have a copy in front of you that you've seen that, so this is an author's amendment. So with that, we'll take the vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Senator Lang, you have your bill in the order you would like it, so please proceed.
Well, good afternoon again, Mr. Chair, members. Today before you, we have Senate File 2853 as amended, which is really a culmination of several years of prior to the pandemic, of serving on the EMSRB, myself being involved in emergency medical services on a civilian side, being concerned with emergency medical services and how they're funded, how they're staffed. All those concerns have led up to, and now, after the pandemic has really taken its wrath on EMS service throughout the state of Minnesota, and some of the what I would call learning experiences that we learned as a state as we proceeded through the pandemic, and how the EMS world responded to that. We have a couple of ideas, and they're really reflected in 2853. So, Mr. Chair, with me today, I have Mr. Buck McAlpin from the Minnesota Ambulance Association, along with Mr. Dylan Ferguson, who is new to the EMSRB, is a new executive director, is just hired, so this will be his trial by fire. And really what it does is this bill sets out a set of changes or exemptions to policy temporarily for the next year that we'd be looking at to help us get through this tough time in the emergency medical services world. So with that being said, I think Buck is probably going to go first, and he'll talk about some of the specifics according to the bill.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Welcome to our committee, Mr. McAlpin. If you would just identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Buck McAlpin. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association today. We've worked probably the last 4 or 5 months since the last peacetime emergency went away and the regulatory board lost their authority on waivers. We've worked very closely with the board to prepare what we thought would be maybe a special session bill to help with waivers. I'm guessing, as I look at this committee, you're all very active in your communities and reach out and visit with your ambulance services, so I'm sure you've heard about some of the issues. I was joking, I talked to an ambulance director this morning who said she's on her 7th day in a row staffing the ambulance because there's nobody else available. The regulatory board at their meeting the other day was talking about 40% of our paramedics have left the workforce. That's not even EMTs. So I think as you continue to talk about workforce issues as a legislature with the governor and look at workforce, we kind of see this now as a long-term look. I can't sit in front of you today and say, Mr. Ferguson and I and the board and the industry have a way to fix this today, but how do we look at it the next few years? We were in kind of a somewhat crisis, especially in rural Minnesota, before the pandemic even hit. But to MDH's testimony earlier and opening up more beds and the moving patients in between facilities, we've really just kind of got to a stress point in the industry. So with sessions starting this early, we really appreciate the opportunity to work with Senator Lang and you to bring the waiver language back. That does some things that Mr. Ferguson can talk about and his team detailed in the memo about ambulance service and licensing, inspections, how often they're done. The supply chain issue has been a huge problem like we're seeing in the healthcare side too, in the hospital side, and some expiration dates that we talked about the other day, Mr. Chair. And staffing is probably the biggest one. That would we rather have the fire department, EMT, or first responder drive the ambulance to be sure the ambulance gets out of the garage in Warren, Minnesota, than not have the ambulance go at all. And it gives the board and their inspectors in rural Minnesota the real authority to be able to implement some of that in a waiver fashion, then make strong statutory changes. We don't think we should come in here and say, committee, we have the cure for everything, change these three statutes, and this problem goes away. We would rather work under this waiver fashion as the industry I represent, and Mr. Ferguson and the EMS Regulatory Board, to be sure we look at long-term fixes, and this waiver option would allow us to do that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Klein, would you, you've got a question now, or would you like to have the second testifier first? Okay, okay, thank you. Welcome to our committee and our state, Mr. Ferguson. It's 2 days now in Minnesota.
Absolutely.
So please introduce yourself for the committee, and then you can continue with your testimony.
Thank you for that warm welcome, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dylan Ferguson. I serve as the new executive director for the Minnesota EMS Regulatory Board. I want to kind of just expand a little bit upon Mr. McAlpin's testimony. And he really did a good job highlighting some of the differences in emergency medical services and the challenges that are being faced versus metro providers here in the metro versus some of the different challenges faced by rural EMS providers in outstate Minnesota. And this is one of the aspects why, from a perspective of a regulatory agency, that SF-2853 really makes a lot of sense. It goes from a perspective of being able to specifically tailor waivers to the specific challenges that are being faced by those individual EMS agencies. This is not necessarily, a blanket process, but rather focuses and allows the technical experts on the EMSRB board along with the staff of the EMSRB to offer the specific technical assistance and to really specifically target solutions at a local level to solve the in the short term the dire challenges that are facing the EMS workforce across this great state. Some of the things that we would really be predominantly focusing on, kind of expiration dates related to EMS agency licenses and inspection in times of an extreme emergency, if that was causing an undue hardship. Buck kind of highlighted some of the aspects related to staffing. And I know that previously that EMSRB staff and board members had received previous questions and consultation about the peacetime emergency and how that would have effects on the various waivers that had previously been extended under 144E. So the EMSRB is excited to be able to work with our industry partners with the Minnesota Ambulance Association and to be able to work with local agencies and chiefs to help identify short-term solutions to provide the necessary relief while this body, amongst others, try to tackle long-term sustainability of emergency medical services overall. And with that, that summarizes my testimony, Mr. Chair, and I think that all three of us would be happy to take any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ling. And just want to, first of all, thank you for bringing this forward. And I'm going to actually relate a little bit of personal experience that shows the relevance and timeliness of the bill. Spent a few shifts this fall and winter as the triage officer down at Mayo Clinic in circumstances where often we were the only hospital in Minnesota, southern Minnesota, or western Wisconsin that had any beds at all. So fielding, you know, requests for transfers from all over creation. And sometimes we would accept the patient from Lake City and they'd say, well, we can't send them now because we just sent our last ambulance down the road to you guys. And then when they get back, you know, they have to go off shift for about 8 hours and then we'll try to send them later. So clearly a dire need and a good response with this legislation to the COVID emergency that we're in. Thank you. And but one question about the bill and the delete everything. In the original bill, there was a section 3 that had a $31.5 million appropriation to the EMSRB. I was going to ask about the nature of that appropriation, but I don't see it mentioned in the delete everything. Has that been eliminated from the bill?
Senator Lang or Mr. McAlpin, I see you moving to the
mic. I can answer that, Mr. Chair and Senator Lang. I'd love to sit here today and say send a little money down the street, but we know that the finance conversation is a bigger one. We talked to Senator Rosen about that last week, and I talked to Chair Utke about that the other day. We're redrafting that language, Senator Klein, with also the piece in there from the Department of Human Services on the load leveling. That might have a little fiscal note to it. As we move patients from a higher level of care to a lower level of care, Regions to Lakeview, happens all day, to make beds available, they're not being paid without the peacetime emergency in place. So that piece we need to get done too. And Mr. Monahan, who's been very quick to respond and draft up these requests for us, is working on that piece now, and we'll reintroduce that as soon as we can as a standalone bill separate from this.
Senator Klein, a follow-up?
So just to clarify, when we vote today, we will not be voting on that appropriation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. I do have an oral amendment to change the dates, if it would be appropriate to do that at this time.
Yes, we would take that. Do you want to offer it, or would you like?
Yeah, I would like to offer it, if that's okay. Sure. Members, I would like to make an oral amendment to the A1 on line 1.11. I would like to strike 2022 and insert 2023. Should we do both of them at the same time? Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, I can speak to the dates.
Go ahead, Senator Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is when we were drafting the initial versions of this bill. I have utmost confidence in the EMSR being able to meet and conduct this in a timely manner. However, that is a kind of a time crunch getting that done by the middle of 2022 summer. So in an effort to give them a little more time to think this through, and I should say us, as I sit on the board too, but I'm a non-voting member, so that is where the impetus comes from. It doesn't provide any further, it's still a temporary deviation and allowing authority for them to do that for only a year, a little over a year from now.
Thank you,
Senator. That was the reasoning.
Senator Dreheim, to your question, the two of oral amendments that you're talking about are on two different amendments, so we...
Chair Utke, I think we need to change lines 1.11 and 1.15, so they both say 2023 instead of 2022.
Yep, you're correct.
So so I would offer the oral amendment on 1.11, strike 2022, insert 2023, and on line 1.15, strike 2022, and insert 2023.
Thank you. And Mr. Monahan, if we've done that all correctly. We're off. Senator Wicklund? Oh, you are muted. There you go.
I had two different boxes to click on there. Sorry. I have a question. I guess most of the other waiver request changes that we're looking at have been ones that are short-term and go through June. And I guess I'd like to know more about how we're supposed to, consider a, basically over a year extension to these without having, a little more detail about what the impact will be, plus any stakeholders who might have questions or concerns about, because there's, there's so many different subdivisions that are included in this, in the bill. So I guess, can you comment on why, how we should be looking at this for over a year extension when we don't have a lot of detail right here other than your testimony today about all the possibilities for these waivers?
Senator Wicklund.
Okay.
My apologies, Chair.
Not a problem. Mr. Ferguson?
Senator Wicklund, I'd be more than happy to try to address some of those concerns. One of the primary impetuses for the longer time period relates specifically to the standard operating procedures of the EMS Regulatory Board. There are only a couple of full board meetings that will actually take place between now and that end date of June 30th of 2022. And when we take a look at that, these are actions which the authority is vested in the full board. So that was one particular reason. The second particular reason is that emergency medical services have faced unique challenges, similar to other healthcare, but from a workforce perspective, EMS across the country, not only here within Minnesota, has faced struggles, and these struggles are not specifically unique to COVID-19 or to other recent emergencies, but rather are more systemic. And what we're hoping to be able to do is to provide immediate, short-term, common sense flexibilities while at the same time working towards longer sustainable solutions with both the House and the Senate. Unfortunately, all of those aspects take time. And we kind of saw what happened when we transitioned out of peacetime emergency back into more traditional operations. And that's when anecdotally we began to hear more and more concerns from EMS agencies, particularly in rural portions of the state. And this is, as the lead agency and the regulatory body for emergency medical services, we're trying to be responsive both to the short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term concerns. And would be more than happy, Senator, if there were more specifics or if you wanted some additional assurances and follow-up conversations, I would be more than happy to have a personal sit-down with you and to try to address any concerns you might have, ma'am.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund, further questions? Did that answer your question, or would you like to follow up?
That helped me understand it better. But I guess it's a little bit harder to judge the difference between, what are the items, what are the specific items that are addressing, a longer term need that you see a need for change versus short term and intermediate term. And I understand if your meeting frequency is not allowing you to, really take action and consider within the first few months. I understand that, but it looks like there's quite a few areas that could be affected by this, and it's hard for me to assess, how many items you're saying are really you're looking for in terms of a long-term versus short-term, and maybe a conversation that would be helpful. And then I guess the second question to follow up then, will you be coming back this session with a specific bill that will address your long-term desires to make changes versus this temporary authority? Thank you.
So, Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wicklund, related, you are correct that there are any number of sections of 144E which are specifically referenced here. The language for that was that those sections were specifically chosen because those were the specific sections that were enumerated in the peacetime emergency section of the statute, which automatically waives all of those sections without any type of board action during a peacetime emergency. So that's the reason for all of the sections being listed there. What I will highlight, similar to Mr. McAlpin's testimony, that the primary sections which are most likely to be impacted likely relate to 144E.101, which specifically relate to EMS staffing for EMS agencies. Potentially 144E.10, and really what we would be looking there is if for some reason there was a needed delay in extending expiration dates, it would give us the authority to be able to extend those dates for licensure. Not highly likely, but it is a possibility. And probably the one that is probably most to be expected, short of 101, would be 144E.103, which speaks to equipment and speaks to those expiration dates and things that had been highlighted previously. That's not to say that the board couldn't issue a waiver related to any number of these sections. However, I will tell you that the predominant focus, both from the stakeholder community and as the lead regulator, relates specifically to those sections. Related to your second question of additional bills and additional solutions, long-term, short-term, I believe that Senator Lang is in the best position to be able to respond to that.
Senator Lang, you want to add a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The short answer to additional bills coming down the pipeline is yes. To which I would answer, I don't know if they're coming this year. Myself and Representative Hewitt have been on the board going on for 2.5-3 years now. I would commend the board and leadership and obviously members of the EMS services as we go forward. We have been working what I would consider in a more positive manner with the board, with legislative intent as we go forward. Myself and Rep. Hewitt have a bunch of ideas along with the board. You may see another bill or two as we proceed forward. I'm not going to rub my crystal ball and tell you when those are going to be dropped. This is kind of the first step as we go forward. This is a big step. This is us trying to reform the EMS services as we go through the state of Minnesota. And I think that we have a couple of unique opportunities as we go forward to reshape exactly how we're doing that in the state of Minnesota. So that's a good non-answer to what the question was, I believe.
Thank you. Senator Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Lang. So the prolongation of the waivers, you know, out to close to 18 months, I share Senator Wicklund's, you know, a little bit of caution about doing that, creating those waivers. One thing that might be reassuring in that regard is if we had some sort of language around notification, as such as there is in the A2 from the Department of Health under 1.24, after 48 hours within an individual waiver goes into effect, the commissioner will notify the ranking members and leads of each of the committees. And it would certainly be helpful if we knew as an HHS committee that these waivers were being invoked by EMSRB within 48 hours of their invocation. Would you be receptive to adding such language?
Senator Lang?
Mr. Chair and Senator Klein, it's funny that you mentioned that. The thought had crossed my mind as well, and that goes with the hand-in-hand or the hand-in-glove that I think the EMSRB and the legislature probably needs to be have, and they've probably needed for many years. I think we're there, and I think that notification, if one was to offer an amendment, that we would be receptive to that.
Senator Klein.
Mr. Chair, I'd be willing to work with council during the course of this meeting to try to get such language drafted if you wanted to table the legislation.
We've got a motion on the table right now that we're, with the change of dates, and we're in the discussion there, so I think we would have to complete that first, and then we could table it till and go on to the second one while you do that. Okay. Any further discussion on the oral amendment, which changed the dates from 2022 to 2023? Seeing none, Senator Dreheim renews his motion to change the dates on lines 1.11 and 1.15 from 2022 to 2023. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Senator Klein, would you like to now make your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'm working with Senate Council rapidly, but not quite that rapidly. But okay. If there's a way to proceed, I will get it done as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you. We will move on. Senator Dreheim, on the A2 amendment, do you have...
Are we ready for A2? Yes, members, I would like to offer the A2 amendment to Senate file 2853 as amended.
Okay. Senator Dreheim, we need to, if you offer it, then we haven't amended it yet. We need to do that.
No, I would like to offer the A2 amendment to the amended 2853.
Okay. Thank you.
And then I'll amend it then.
Perfect. Members, the A2 amendment that you have in your packets, and would you like to just revisit that and give us a little, we should have a little bit about what the A2 amendment is. It is what we heard from the department when we first started.
My understanding, this is agreed upon language. With one caveat, we will be doing an oral amendment to cut out lines 1.21 to 1.23. And that was recommended by all parties involved, from my understanding.
Okay. Well, we'll bring the A2 amendment forward then. So
yeah.
We have the A2 before us. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. The A2 is before us. And with that, we have an oral amendment, but I think I will call on Mr. Monahan. You've made some... the proper edits to what we want to do. So would you tell us what that'll look like?
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment would be to amend the A2 amendment to Senate file 2853 as follows. Page 1, line 16, after the semicolon, insert and. Page 1, line 19, after COVID-19, delete the semicolon. Page 1, delete lines 20 through 22. And page 1, line 23, delete everything before the period.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Members, this just deletes all language related to funeral directors, in particular, extending the dates that they may hold a deceased body. Abler? Senator Abler.
Well, thanks, and I've not been very deeply involved in this discussion. Perhaps somebody could just, for the sake of the public, say why we're not going to do that. I don't know if it's a good or a bad idea, but just for the sake of discussion, I don't mind it either way, so thanks.
Thank you, Senator Abler. It was something that, well, I guess bottom line is MDH, Department of Health, recommended that it be removed. Originally, there was even some more language, the funeral directors, et cetera. It didn't come from them, and they weren't in favor of it. This one, they were kind of neutral on this, but the department asked that it be removed. It just took everything related to funeral directors and the removals of bodies, et cetera, out of the language.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler.
That kind of makes the whole amendment a lot cheerier, too, not talking about dead bodies. And thanks. I think it's a good amendment to make it cheerier. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions on the A2 amendment as amended? Or I guess we're gonna be doing the amendment to the amendment. So, okay. We will vote to approve the oral amendment to the A2 amendment. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. A2 is amended. Now, Senator Klein, everything good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and I have an oral amendment to the A1 amendment, which I think Mr. Monahan can report, if that's okay.
Mr. Monahan.
Mr. Chair, yikes.
Equipment failure.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Klein moves to amend the A1 amendment to Senate File 2853 as follows. Page 1, after line 15, insert a new paragraph D to read, no later than 48 hours after suspending a requirement under this section, the Executive Director of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board must provide written notice of the suspended requirements to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over the EMSRB.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Senator Lang, did you get all that?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that the three of us at the table are good with the proposed amendment.
That's it. Okay. Thank you. Members, any comments, questions? Okay. All those, we will vote on the oral amendment just presented by Mr. Monahan. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? That passes. Okay. Now we are back to Senate File 2853 as amended. Okay. Good. Back up one step here. With A2, now we will take, and we need to adopt the A1 into the A2 amendment. So we'll vote on that for the A2 amendment. Everybody understand what we're going to be doing? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? That passes. Okay. Now we have Senate File 2853 as amended before us. Senator Dreheim, would you renew your motion that Senate File 2853 be passed as amended and sent to general orders? Okay, thank you. Members, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Now, item number 3 on our agenda today is an update on the Certified Nursing Assistants Recruitment and Training Plan. We have with us, I believe, all online, starting off, Commissioner Dennis Olson with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. When he pops up here on the screen, you can start by please identifying yourself and continue with your testimony. There he is.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Utke and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson, and I currently serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to share a brief overview of an exciting and successful initiative my colleagues across the state and I have been working to stand up and implement, called the Next Generation Nursing Assistant Program. I'm joined today by Valerie DeFore, the Executive Director of the Health Force Center of Excellence at Minnesota State. And I'm also joined by Nikki Oliver, our Director of Government Relations, who's going to be advancing slides for me. Nikki, you can move to the next one. So, Mr. Chair and members, in late November of last year, 2021, Governor Walz issued a call to action, including setting an aggressive goal to recruit, train, and ultimately deploy 1,000 new nursing assistants by January 31st of this year, 2022. And he asked me to lead the interagency initiative and also to make sure we include representatives from multiple state agencies, as well as state agency commissioners, providers within long-term care, as well as the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And as you're all probably well aware, we know this is a much larger issue than what was stated in this initial goal of 1,000 set out by Governor Walz. As according to Department of Employment and Economic Development DEED data, we have over 15,000 current CNA vacancies statewide, but this initiative gives us the opportunity for some immediate relief in some of our long-term care facilities that were the most significantly impacted by staffing shortages. In fact, 400 members of the National Guard were deployed to serve as nursing assistants to assist these long-term care facilities all across the state. And the key goal of the initiative is to provide a demobilization strategy for the Guard, really to help these citizen soldiers return to their civilian lives. And just again, want to take a moment here to sincerely thank the members of the Guard for stepping up to answer the call here during this time. And you know, we all recognize and appreciate their service, especially during this difficult period here. But through the support of the governor and the legislature, we were able to secure a budget utilizing federal ARPA dollars that has supported what we've been calling a barrier-free pathway for Minnesotans to earn their nursing assistant credential in a short amount of time and enter the workforce. And the budget has allowed us to cover all related expenses, including tuition and training expenses, books, materials, scrubs, any technology support a student may need, as well as other student supports, again, that an individual student may require and need. Next slide, please. So like I mentioned earlier, our interagency working group began meeting in late November and immediately began working on developing the recruitment component, building awareness through a multitude of different channels, really, including social media, local engagement efforts. The recruitment is currently ongoing. You know, just 6 weeks ago in early January, we were able to formally contract with the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. You can go back to the slide. So we were able to contract with Minnesota State, and classes started almost immediately at the beginning of January. And, you know, starting within days, we'll have our first group of over 300 students eligible to take the certification exam. And finally, the most important aspect of this initiative is to, of course, connect trainees to employment. And this is an ongoing effort. You'll hear more about it later on in the presentation. Next slide, please. So on this particular slide, you can see the multitude of different efforts that were utilized to help spread the word and connect interested students to the opportunity here. One of the first efforts we employed was to utilize the existing Health Force Center of Excellence website to gather interest from Minnesotans. Well over 1,200 people entered their information on that form and all received individual communication back. You know, I just have to say this alone was a pretty Herculean effort, making sure students were connected to appropriate options that best met their needs. And, you know, we then from there developed a more comprehensive webpage on the Office of Higher Education website and have since been able to develop social media assets, as well as provide communications toolkits and marketing toolkits to make sure we ensure the consistency of the messaging. And you may have seen, you know, we've had a lot of media interest as well. We've had numerous stories in print, in radio, some TV news coverage, and many of those stories we were really happy with because they were able to feature and center current students and recent program completers as well. One of the most important pieces I'm proud of is that we were able to also organize 20 local engagement calls in which we connected with county emergency managers, with local city mayors, with school superintendents, local college presidents, city administrators, as well as local public health representatives, you know, and ask them for their partnership, particularly in those areas in Minnesota that were experiencing the most significant need within long-term care. And then finally, on the bottom there, just have to recognize we were able to send a letter to all 201 members of the legislature, not only to share some information, but also to request some support in helping to spread the word. And For everyone here on the committee, I want to thank each and every one of you for the time you took to share information with your constituents and to reach out and ask us questions for clarification as well. Next slide. So this may be the most exciting slide of the presentation because I'm happy to report our most recent data shows that we have 314 students that have completed the training thus far and another 463 students that are currently enrolled in training programs. And that alone is something to celebrate, but we also have 338 high school students across the state that are enrolled in programs, many of which have recently completed as of the end of January or will complete their programs within weeks. And we have plenty of capacity remaining and continue to make courses available to students that are interested in addition to addressing waiting lists in areas of high demand. And, at this time, I'd like to invite Valerie DeFore to share more here if she'd like, and then take the driver's seat from here.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Ms. DeFore, welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and then you can continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Aki. Yes, I'm Valerie DeFore, the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Health Force Center of Excellence, which is hosted by Winona State University, but serves our entire state and all of our colleges and universities and our healthcare employers. I have to say, this has just been a pleasure to work with Commissioner Olson and all the other agency representatives and association members who have really come together collaboratively to implement this nursing assistant initiative. So Commissioner Olson brought us up to the testing component of the project. So we can go to that slide, thank you. The first class that started under the Next Generation Initiative started December 20th, and it completed on January 3rd. So that was a class that was able to get stood up right away and just went out the door super fast. 14 students were in that class, and of those 14, 14 passed their certification exam. So we feel really positive about that. We could present that as 100% pass rate, but it is one class. Minnesota has been in a transition time as we were implementing this project with regard to nursing assistant testing. A new vendor has been chosen to conduct the testing platform and support nursing assistant testing for Minnesota. So there was a blackout period as we transitioned from one vendor to another. So we've had no testing taking place since January 15th. But the really good news is that just this week now, we are in the midst of MDH and our testing sites are piloting the new testing vendor. And we feel really confident about moving forward very quickly to get testing up and running back to full speed and full steam ahead with testing. So we'll go to the next slide, please. So employment is, of course, the ultimate goal of this initiative. Every training program was required to provide some type of employment information to its students. And we've given you some examples on the slide. This approach really recognizes that most students will be looking for employment within their community or surrounding region. But as you heard from Commissioner Olson, we have been astonished by the interest in this initiative. And we don't want to lose anyone who has come forward and given us their information through our input form and have said they're interested in being a nursing assistant. So to that end, DEED and with Career Force, we'll be holding a statewide job fair or career connection event that all students will be invited to, as well as all of those 1,200 plus people on our I'm interested list, so that we can really capitalize on their interest and engagement and make connections for them to become nursing assistants, even outside of this Next Generation Initiative. We are reaching the end of our funding for this work. At the same time, we're close to reaching our goal. So what we are also doing is being in touch with all of these people who were interested but have not yet found a free class that worked for them or that was in their geography. And so we're reaching out to them with other ideas and suggestions and connections so that we can help them obtain the training and future employment that they desire. We are also doing, the marketing group is doing some work as well, just to help us help our state's employers in recruitment of these students. So it really is a cross-agency body of work here. So we'll go to the next slide now. So obviously, we will be doing some evaluation of this work. Some of that is very quantitative. And if we go to the next slide, some examples of what we will be measuring are how many students enrolled, how many completed, how many passed the test, how many got jobs. A lot of that is data-driven and data, data-heavy work. But we have also enjoyed this work because it gives us a chance to do some things that are innovative. So if we go to that slide, thank you. Some of the innovation is already underway. We have a student support success coach who holds online office hours at a variety of times during the day. And she's available to any student anywhere in the state to come into her virtual office hours and get some assistance and help. We're looking at doing things related to credit for prior learning so that these students who become nursing assistants, maybe they want to go on and take another step down that healthcare career pathway. So with credit for prior learning, that gives them just a little bit of a nice little reward or a nice little starting point for them as if they want to advance their training. We've also had a variety of innovative ways of offering this class. A lot of it has been hybrid courses, so there's online content combined with in-person skills training. And sometimes that means, if we take northeastern Minnesota, for example, all the students might be in their online class together, but then they're gonna go to their skills lab at one of our campuses in Hibbing or in Virginia so that they can get that hands-on experience that they need without having to travel great distances. So we've been experimenting with that concept. We've also just heard from high schools about their interest and how they have students and how can we support them. Can we have afternoon classes for students who maybe have the ability to they've saved all their study halls till that senior year and now they have some capacity in their schedule. We have heard from Carleton College students. I'm an Ole, but I love what Carleton College came forward with. They said that we have a group of students. We are interested in volunteering at our local nursing homes, but volunteering is not what is needed right now. What's needed is nursing assistants. And so they've reached out and said, can we become nursing assistants? And so we're working to make that happen. And as we were thinking innovatively, we thought, well, maybe this could be a college challenge. Could be build off of that excitement and that idea. So we're doing a lot of innovative things and thinking about future innovation. I have to plug our Scrubs camps. We are looking forward to a summer Scrubs camp that will be the nursing assistant edition. So Minnesota HOSA is going to help us figure that out and offer that. Lots of exciting innovation now and in the future. And we'll go one more slide, please. So, I had to advance it on my slide. If I had to give you two takeaways and on this initiative, I just have to tell you that I think we have learned that free upfront training is essential, I think, to getting the workforce we need in this nursing assistant space. That is really the change that we made with the opportunity to have funding to support, a barrier-free, as Commissioner Olson said, access to nursing assistant training. We also think that the publicity has really elevated this occupation and the need for nursing assistants, and that Minnesotans are hearing that and coming forward and wanting to, you know, become that healthcare hero. Maybe if we just go to the next slide. As always, you know, we're always thinking ahead. What are the next steps? We have waiting lists in some of our classes. We have people on this input form list, the I'm interested list, who haven't been able to get a free class. So we're really hoping that we can find some funds to get all of those people into a class and support them as they become nursing assistants. Maybe we're looking at a different funding model, even, you know, long term, for how we do nursing assistant training in Minnesota. And then finally, we are going to do some things to support these new nursing assistants. They're going to be entering a workplace that is at probably the most stressed level anyone can remember. And so we want that handoff into employment and that transition to be successful for them. So we're looking at starting just a virtual community of practice where they can come together and, you know, just share what's happened, what did they learn, what were they surprised by, what challenges they're facing, and that they can have that space to talk freely with their peers and with a qualified faculty member who can, you know, assist them along the way. I think that brings us to the last slide, which is opening it up for questions or discussion.
I do have on the list that Assistant Commissioner Reidrich might comment. Is it part of the presentation or just to help answer questions?
Mr. Chair, I think I was asked just.
Okay, the connection is not coming through.
Oh no. Are you able to hear me?
Now we can hear you.
Okay, apparently I have to lean in. Mr. Chair, I think I was asked just to comment on the initiative because it's so closely tied to the work that we've been doing to support long-term care with the health department. And I'll just briefly say, I just want to really applaud Commissioner Olson and his staff and the team at Minnesota State for this, because it is really an incredibly exciting initiative. And one of the things that's been really difficult during the response over the last 2 years is that we're focused so much on just trying to get through each wave, trying to help hospitals, trying to help nursing homes and group homes just get through a crisis. And this is about building something for the future that's really exciting. And, you know, I've participated in a lot of the community forums that happened around this, and just echo Commissioner Olson that there was so much excitement and interest in being part of the solution and really bringing some of these opportunities to high school students and college students and mid-career folks in these communities, and to be a part of helping to rebuild the workforce in an industry that's really been through a lot. So I would just offer my kudos to them for a job well done and say I hope we can keep doing this in the future, because as the commissioner noted, 1,000 is a fantastic starting point, but we know there's a need for a lot more in the future.
Thank you. We have questions lining up here. So Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Ecke. And thank you for the work you guys are doing on this, vitally important. But I just a little unpacking on the testing portion of the presentation. To roll out a program and then change vendors, was that a planned decision or was that something that had to happen? Can you just elaborate a little bit on that for us, please?
Mr. Olson?
Yeah.
Ms. DeFore.
Apologies. Yes. Senator Dreheim, members, that was just an unfortunate situation with timing. The vendor switch was, as you can imagine, it was an RFP. It, you know, went through the bidding process. It was quite an involved undertaking. Minnesota Department of Health is over that area, and so it was just an unfortunate timing. situation that happened. We have worked closely with the Department of Health, with the new vendor, to really make that blackout period and that transition time as small as it can be, to really minimize any impact that the testing vendor switch would have.
Senator Graham.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for that answer. So you expect quite a few more kids signing up for the exams? Because 14,
absolutely.
Yeah,
excuse me.
14 is an extremely low number, in my opinion, for the number of people that went through the program. And you have the capacity at the testing center to do that?
Ms. DeFore.
Yes, Senator Draheim and members. We will have the capacity to test all of these next generation nursing assistants students. The 14, that was just a class that got done prior to the blackout period. That means they finished before January 15th. The majority of our classes, you know, started at the beginning of January, so they were not complete and hit the blackout period. So, but we absolutely want to test them all. That's the expectation. That's what they expect. These students want to take that test and pass and become, you know, get on the registry and have that credential. So we feel very comfortable with making that happen.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments and questions. So there is much to applaud here. I see a lot of innovation, which is always good in the workplace and in education. I particularly want to note the change from a reimbursement model to an upfront model. I think that should make it much easier to get CNA trainees in the program. So I think that was an important piece to do. I do have just a few questions. You know, it's always important to know that we're using funds most wisely as possible and we're not duplicating previous efforts, for example. So I wanted to talk a minute about the high school students. And this is I appreciate the fact that you're training where the young students are, which are in high school, not waiting necessarily just for post-high school. But I do want to know, you know, there are programs in our high schools, PSEO programs, for example, and also particular things like Bridges to Healthcare comes to mind in several areas. And I want to know, how do the additional federal funds being used for this marry up with the state funds that are being used for things like PSEO, Bridges to Healthcare, those type of things?
Ms. DeFore?
Yes, thank you, Chair Ecke, and Commissioner Olson may well want to supplement what my response is. We are using these funds that were allocated through the ARP process to purchase equipment for high schools to have a nursing assistant lab. We didn't talk about that in the presentation, but there are high schools who would like to offer this nursing assistant program, but they don't have the equipment. So that's one use of those dollars that I think is exciting because it builds capacity. Otherwise, the funds that are a part of this initiative that go towards high school students are going to support them in taking the NATO exam, because school districts don't, as a matter of course, pay for certification tests for their students. So we are not, we see that as a value add of this work instead of, you know, duplication or supplanting any other funding. So that's the engagement of the dollars with the high school students.
Thank you. Mr.
Olson, I think, wanted to jump in and participate in this answer also.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. My apologies. I didn't mean to step on your next question there. I just wanted to also build upon what Valerie shared and that the Department of Education, Minnesota Department of Education, is currently in the process of awarding up to 10 grants to high school districts that were interested in either building upon, like Valerie said, their existing CNA training programs by adding to existing labs to provide more space for training, but also an opportunity for districts that don't have current CNA training programs to be able to add one. And so up to 10 grants were made available through this federal funding that'll assist high schools in starting up.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Olson, that's just what I was looking to hear, that there's been this collaboration with our existing K-12 system, or in this case, our high school, our pathways in CNAs or our PSEO. So thank you. That's what I was looking for there. And then just a couple brief follow-up questions, and I'll just mention them both because I think they're at the same time. They're short answers. One, I'd like to know, what is the cost for that NATO exam on an individual basis? And I'm glad to see that it's being covered. That has been a problem with some students. And then secondly, I wanted to address a minute the public providers. I have a provider in my district who has been providing a CNA training for several years. That's her business. And I want to know, how did you work with private providers who are providing CNA training? How are you helping them? Or is this just, in a sense, a competition to those private providers?
Ms. DeFour or Mr. Olson, whoever. Ms. DeFour.
Thank you, Chair and Senator Nelson. The cost of the NATO exam is approximately $225 per student.
Thank you.
It might vary slightly, but that's where we're landing. It's very similar to the price of the previous vendor. So we haven't had any budgetary impact from switching vendors. Regarding the integration or the use of private training companies, yes, so there's 233 approved nursing assistant training programs in Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Health is the entity that approves them. What we did with this project was things that could go fast went fast. So setting up within our Minnesota state system across all of the geography was fast. We did send, let me just back up and say, I think we've all come to the table and said, this is kind of an all hands on deck. We say that with all of the initiatives or all of the ideas. It's always kind of a yes and approach. And so the Department of Health sent out an email to all of the approved training programs, so the 233, which included a link to a survey asking for their ability, interest, capacity to participate in the next generation nursing assistant effort. And what we did is we looked at where we needed training. Maybe there was a special geography that needed to be covered. Maybe we had a Minnesota State campus wasn't able to provide stand up a class. So there was a geography that didn't really have good access. We looked at who had large capacity, who could also move fast. And then we also looked at where could we make decisions based on where the National Guard is deployed and make sure we're building capacity in those communities. So ultimately, to date, we have five private training programs involved in this effort. HeartCert and OnTrack are large training providers. What's great about OnTrack in particular is that they their model is sort of based on a facility-based approach. So it's online with skills and clinicals, at a skilled nursing facility. And so they've enrolled 100 students through through this initiative. But these students are all over Minnesota, which is kind of nice. It's not like five classes of 20 in five locations. We have four students up in Roseau through OnTrack's training capacity. So they've allowed us to get into a kind of smaller, more communities than we would be able to with, a class of 20 here or there. We've also started the other three. Benedictine up in Crookston is part of this. They just got, we just got contracts and everything worked out with them last week. They are in a community where the Guard has been and is in dire need. So we were excited to partner with them. They provide training not only for themselves, but their sister or, neighboring skilled nursing facilities in that region. And then we have a private training South Central Service Co-op down here in North Mankato. And then there's a small training provider in near Hayfield, but not in Hayfield. I'm blanking on the name. But we wanted, we chose them because the Guard is deployed in Hayfield and they were able to do eight students. So one of the things I think we've learned, is that this does take everyone. It's all hands on deck. We did not see this as a, that Minnesota State could just, do this solely on our own. If we do more of this, and if we have more time to kind of plan an implementation strategy, we might well have, a different makeup of training providers. But this was the fastest and most efficient way that we saw forward to meeting the goal.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a closing comment.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the long explanation. And I would say, though, that is concerning when we have $3 million, over $3 million, and there are only five private providers. I know private providers that were Red Cross approved providers that for some reason were not, I don't know why they were missed. And I think that's a challenge. Anytime we take public dollars and usurp private providers. So I am concerned about that, but I understand the need for speed. I do appreciate the innovations that have happened here. And I just want to mention that going forward, I think it's important that we look at those private qualified, certified providers as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Next up, we have Senator Abler and Senator Wicklund. I do see your hand up online. You'll follow Senator Abler. So, Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. This is a really good discussion, and I want to congratulate you all for getting nearly 800 people. Some of us thought that's a tall order to get 1,000, and so we need many more, of course, but thanks for your success. So there's 3.4 million and maybe 800 people doing this. That's like $4,000 a person. Is that what you think it costs, or could you break down what it costs per individual and how you spent if it's 4,000? I just did the math, roughly chopped it up there. So can you maybe just go through the cost of the program just briefly? We're running out of time, but if it's not available, I'd like a breakdown offline. So, but see what you can do for now, please. And I suppose that would be Mr. Four, maybe?
Mr. Four?
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Abler, members. Yes, we did a budget of $3.4 million to train 1,000. The instruction estimates were $1,200 per student for instruction. We've included costs of books and scrubs, which brings that up to about $1,300 per student. We built in a model that would allow low enrollment courses to continue to be offered instead of being canceled. We included in our budget the equipment for the high schools. And then we included things like student support services, which we thought we would need to recruit and retain and get into employment nursing assistants. Like you said, I didn't know where we would find 777 or 1,000 back at, you know, in the middle of December. So we had an idea that maybe we needed to do some incentives or something to support students through employment. And so that amount of money is now being actually reallocated to try to add more capacity so we could train more than 1,000. But that budget was $750,000 that we really haven't needed to implement in the way that we thought. There was some marketing funds built into this because we thought we would have to do a real intensive marketing push, and that has not happened. It hasn't been needed to the extent we thought it was. So we are working on analyzing, you know, the various components of this budget and figuring out how to reallocate so that we can, you know, train, you know, more than our original goal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. Those are very encouraging numbers. And so there's a lot of people who are interested in trying to promote this. And so on Tuesday, we'll be talking about some of the Senate's approaches toward retention and training. And I think I'm kind of happy that it might actually work the way we set it up. So we'll look forward to that and continue to work with you in partnership. And, your governor is in one party and I'm in a different one, but this is nothing about partisanship. This is about making sure we get the staff we need to serve the people who are so vulnerable. So I just want to say congratulations to you on that. And I appreciate your candor about the funds and all that. And I hope you can stretch them to get, you know, even 2,000. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And am I still okay there? I had a question about high schools, but that's been answered. And I just wanted to say that I hope that going forward that, you know, you're going to be continuing to have some outreach to high schools, because I know in Bloomington we've got a career academy, and I know one of the tracks is a healthcare track, and it seems like this would be really a good fit for students who can participate through their high school program to get a credential like this. And I know they have started some of that work. So I hope for future planning that will be part of it. I appreciate your presentation and how comprehensive your approach was over such a short period of time to be able to bring this all together. And I really look forward to seeing if there are ways we can extend this model as a, you know, model for other other efforts in the same field, or look at other fields that might be good opportunities. I'm thinking of child care would be another one. There's the CDA, child development associate or a credential. I think I'm getting the initials wrong, but the CDA is another credential that is fairly short in terms of how much time it takes to get, but you know, maybe there would be a way that we could apply this kind of effort to bringing more more people into the child care profession as well. So very supportive of your work, and I think it's great that we have so many people coming through the program. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, any further questions or presenters? If not, Commissioner Olson, Ms. DeFore, and Ms. Redrick, thank you for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate the update and all of your information. So with that, members, we have reached the end of our agenda. We will have full agendas the way it looks next Monday and Wednesday. So with that, we will stand adjourned till Monday. Thank you.